Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, planet Earth is facing a sixth mass extinction. Can humanity rescue the planet that it has imperiled? Then, April is a notorious month for genocide and mass human rights abuses. We'll analyze the forces of genocide and the means of preventing future genocides. Planet Earth has faced five mass extinctions in its lifetime. Now, we may be facing the sixth. What have we learned from the previous mass extinctions that can help us avoid a total collapse? With us is Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, and her latest, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Also with us is Annalee Newitz. She is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee Newitz is the founding editor of the science website, io9.com, and a longtime science journalist. I thought we should start with the brief history that you both give us of the planet Earth, the five extinctions that precede the one that we were facing now, the sixth extinction. Elizabeth Colbert, let's start with you. You trace this history kind of through the eyes of scientists and how they're figuring out what's happening in each case. What do we know about the causes and consequences of the preceding mass extinctions?
In each case, you're trying to solve a mystery that goes back many millions of years, so there's sort of cold case going back a long, long time. But the very first one of these five, what are known as the Big Five mass extinctions, is about 140 million years ago, and that was a time when life was still largely confined to the water, so it was very devastating for aquatic species, but not for land species, because there were no land species, and it seems that that was caused by a cold snap, actually, the causes of which no one knows exactly, but there was a very sudden glaciation of a lot of the planet. And then the very most devastating of all these extinctions was the third, about 250 million years ago, and that came perilously close to wiping out multicellular life altogether. And that, it seems, was caused by, and there are some very unfortunate parallels to what's going on today, by a very, very massive outflux of carbon dioxide, a very massive bout of global warming, ocean acidification. And the very last one, the most recent, about 66 million years ago, the most famous, most popular, as you will, did in the dinosaurs and a lot of other familiar groups, the pterosaurs, for example. And it seems pretty clear that that was caused by an asteroid impact.
Annalee Newitz, you've also explored these. What would you add?
Elizabeth is right on the money in emphasizing the way that these have all been, you know, precipitated by different events, but the result is that all five of the mass extinctions kind of come down to habitat change and climate change. And each of them has different features. One was an ice age, one was caused by mega volcanoes. But in the end, the reason why we see so much death is because over a period of hundreds of thousands of years, the climate changes. And of course, when we talk about climate change in the context of mass extinction, you have to consider the definition of mass extinction, which is a period of about a million or 2 million years during which over 75% of all species on the planet go extinct. And so this sounds like a long period of time, but geologically speaking, it's an incredibly short period of time to see such devastating losses among species. What's particularly concerning for people now is looking at this pattern, looking back and seeing, okay, these previous mass extinctions were precipitated by habitat changes and climate changes, and then also looking at the records that we have now of the numbers of species that are going extinct, and we can see a pattern emerging that looks a lot like these previous patterns of mass extinction.
You've each talked about essentially the glaciation, the third that was also a global warming one, and then the one by the asteroid which killed off the dinosaurs. What about the second and fourth? Do we need to know about those as well, Elizabeth Colbert?
The causes are very much debated. It's only about 20 years, maybe 25 years now, that there's been sort of a general consensus, and even that I would have to say is not a total consensus about what caused the most recent of these extinctions at the end of the Cretaceous period. And when people just confirmed, guess that that was an asteroid impact, they found a crater buried beneath a lot of other newer sediment in the Gulf of Mexico. they went back to these other moments and thought, well, it would be very elegant if each one of these had been caused by an asteroid impact, and went to look for signs of that and just didn't find them. So there's still a lot of debate swirling around. As I say, you're looking at events that occurred a very, very long time ago.
It was very interesting reading through how these scientists were essentially coming to their realizations of what had happened through your book, The Sixth Extinction, almost like a cross between a mystery story and a history book.
Sort of CSI, but the corpse has been dead for many, many millions of years.
We're dealing with essentially climate and habitat. One of the great extinctions was also climate. Are there things we can learn specifically from that, with the global warming that brought that on, and how we're dealing with the global warming of today? Annalee Newitz?
One thing that we can learn that's really obvious is that climate changes tend to precipitate these incredibly catastrophic events. Some of the other mass extinctions, for example, the ones that you mentioned, the sort of mysterious ones, both also involved, to varying degrees, invasive species. And that's another key link with what we're seeing today, where a lot of habitat changes on the planet aren't just being caused by climate change, but also by invasive species and how that's transformed different habitats for animals. The most obvious lesson that we can learn is that if we want to continue living on a planet that is comfortable for us and for our ecosystems, which of course we depend on our ecosystems to live, we need to be working very hard to remediate the effects of the climate changes that we're seeing. And the thing that's interesting about that is that, in a sense, that's a very unnatural thing to do, because if there's one thing you learn from looking at the history of mass extinction, it's that the planet is constantly undergoing these climate changes. And so for humans to, you know, come along and change the climate, whether to make it less comfortable for us as we are now or make it more comfortable for us, we are intervening in a natural process. But the fact is that right now we're in danger, and so our first task has to be looking at the ways that we can prevent further climate changes from happening.
Elizabeth Colbert, would you agree?
Absolutely. Many, many scientists are looking at this precisely because of some pretty sobering parallels that people see between what's happening now and what happened in the past. And I think one of the lessons people have extracted from the record, I mean, the very definition, as Annalee said, of a mass extinction is an event that takes place in geologically a very short amount of time. And some of these extinctions probably happen pretty quickly, certainly on geological terms, is that when the world changes very fast, and, you know, it sort of intuitively makes sense, for whatever reason, you know, evolutionary processes, their pace doesn't change fast enough, and a lot of creatures get left behind. That seems to be sort of the bottom line inference that you can draw from these events. You know, the rate at which we are changing the atmosphere and therefore the climate, and also I should point out the chemistry of the oceans, which is implicated in several of these events of the past, is perhaps unprecedented since the end Permian extinction, which, as I mentioned, is sort of the worst extinction of the last half billion years. So that's a very sobering precedent, let's put it that way.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, let's talk about some of the changes that we are observing that you documented in the book, and then let's talk a little bit more, Annalee Newitz, about some of the ways in which it could be possible to address these. You had chapters about some amphibians. You had a chapter on penguins. You talked about coral reefs, bats, sharks, something like 25% of mammals heading for extinction. It's pretty dire. Let's start with the penguins. What happened?
I should point out they were called penguins, but that was a complete misunderstanding. They're actually very, very distantly related to penguins. That was a great auk, I think, that you're referring
right,
to.
Right, that was the great auk.
That's a flightless bird that lived in the northern hemisphere, and then when people saw sort of somewhat similar, though they really don't look that much alike, birds in the southern hemisphere, they also called them penguins. But the great auk was sort of the original penguin. It was called a penguin before Europeans had encountered actual penguins. And those were flightless birds. Flightless birds, as we know, are very vulnerable to human predation. They are a very, very generally threatened group of animals right now, and many of them are gone, the dodo being, you know, perhaps the most famous. And the great auk was dodo-like, a big bird, waddled around, good eating, good, was used for just in a variety of ways, was just slaughtered, had these nesting colonies of, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of birds and made very easy picking. So one of the stories that I tell in the book is about this island that is in Newfoundland off the coast. And when European sailors found their way to the great cod fishery off of Canada in the 1500s already, they realized that this island in the summer was covered with these birds and that they made extremely easy pickings and good eating, you know, at a time when you had just completed a pretty grueling transatlantic journey. And they just absolutely, you know, mowed them down, in that case, for food. Then they decided, oh, they were going to be good for feathers, too. Then they were killed for feathers. The birds themselves were lit on fire. They're very fatty. They were used basically to make fires. So it's really a pretty gruesome tale of slaughter, and eventually they were slaughtered down to nothing.
And is this a common story? Some of the others, the bats, for example, is not from humans eating bats. It's from some kinds of diseases that is a result of perhaps globalization. What are the other extinctions related to?
There are all sorts of mechanisms right now that are driving extinction, unfortunately, you know, sort of all at the same time. I mean, climate change is probably going to become a major driver of extinctions for fairly obvious reasons. You know, creatures are adapted to certain conditions and we're changing them very rapidly. Ocean acidification, which is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, that is also almost certainly a very significant driver of extinctions. Moving species around the world, the bats in the northeastern U.S. are dying from a fungus that was brought almost certainly from Europe. We've traced that back genetically. It was probably brought over, you know, completely inadvertently. It turned out to be very fatal for American bats. You know, obviously, habitat destruction, mowing down the rainforest, that's a big one, a bad one. Habitat fragmentation. So there's a pretty big list of them here. I guess I've named most of the big ones.
You mentioned the ocean acidification twice. We've talked about this on this program quite a bit. What's happening that's causing this, and what is the result?
Well, ocean acidification is really happening because when we pour carbon dioxide into the air, as we are by, you know, burning gasoline and burning oil and burning coal, a lot of it ends up in the water. It just gets absorbed by the surface waters of the ocean, which cover, you know, a lot of the planet, about 70% of the planet surface area. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it has an interesting property, which is that it forms an acid, carbonic acid. So it's a pretty relatively simple chemical process that's going on. We're dissolving CO2 in the water, and we are acidifying the oceans. The oceans should be pretty basic for those who remember their high school chemistry, with a pH of around 8.2, and that is dropping once again at a rate which people have tried to compare over vast stretches of geological time. And there have been several papers that have come out that have concluded that the rate at which we're acidifying the oceans is quite possibly, you know, unprecedented in hundreds of millions of years.
And so is this also connected to the coral reef die-off?
Yes, absolutely. There are a lot of things we're doing that corals don't like. They don't like it when the water heats up a lot. They don't like it when the water gets cloudy. They don't like it when there's a lot of agricultural runoff. They certainly don't like it when there's overfishing. But they also really don't like it when the chemistry of the water changes. And very many, many, you know, hundreds of experiments have now been run that demonstrate that. And so, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef, all of these factors are operative, really, on most of the major reefs right now. Studies suggest that the Great Barrier Reef, which is the biggest reef in the world, has lost 50% of its coral cover just in the last 3 decades.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking about the 6th mass extinction on Earth. Annalee Newitz, let's bring you back in here. You've been arguing that, yes, while humanity is causing all kinds of problems with the mass extinction, that it also might be able to solve these problems. Let's talk about some of those potential solutions.
Sure. First of all, I think the thing to keep in mind is that it's very likely that humans will survive a mass extinction. If you look back at previous mass extinctions, at the kinds of animals that tend to survive, they share a lot of characteristics with humans, namely that they can live in a lot of different environments the way we can, and they're very adaptable, and also they can generally eat a lot of different things. And as you may have noticed, humans are pretty good at eating almost anything, including garbage. So the question is really not whether we will survive, but how we will survive. And so what I urge people to think about in my book is, you know, how we can act now to prevent the future of our survival from being horrible. because what it means to live through a mass extinction is not something that is exciting, as you might guess from a Hollywood film where you see lots of explosions. Basically, living through a mass extinction means starving and getting diseases. Some of the things that Elizabeth talked about so amazingly in her book, where she talks about animals that are suffering from diseases that are caused by habitat changes that are a part of mass extinction patterns. So how do we survive? I mean, first of all, we have to think about the places where humans live. What are the places where we live, and how can we improve them so that we're living in the environment in a way that's not destroying it and not undermining animals' abilities to survive as well, animals other than humans? I talk a lot about how we can change city life, because cities are the place where most humans live now. The majority of humans live in cities, and that's only going to grow. The UN is projecting that by the end of this century, we're going to see as much as 75% of the human population living in cities. And cities are good in some ways environmentally, in the sense that you can scale needs for energy and needs for food better if you have people more densely packed. The other thing that's good about cities, ultimately, if we can make them sustainable and carbon neutral, is that it's a way of keeping people out of habitats that really should belong to other species. And one of the things that's really important as we think about the future and as we think about making a better future is reserving habitats for other creatures, creatures other than ourselves, habitats like the ocean, habitats like savannas where animals need lots of space and they need migratory space. And it's a very difficult balancing act, because how do you create spaces for humans to grow our food and our energy, as well as spaces for animals? And so that's going to be a huge question, I think, over the next century,
and
is how we do that.
And with the UN projecting that we're going to have more than 9 billion people by 2050, how realistic is this?
Like I said, I think that's why cities become such an important issue, both environmentally and politically, because if we can take that population and keep people in cities, and I don't mean keep them in there, like imprison them, but I mean if people are living in cities, that actually gives us an excellent opportunity to think about how we start reserving these areas that people are leaving, these rural areas, and start reserving them for wildlife and for natural habitats, either by remediating habitats that are no longer comfortable for animals and making them comfortable again, or by just maintaining habitats that haven't been developed yet. So the thing that's, like I said, great about cities is that it's a way of scaling resources in a really good way, because people are densely packed, but it's also a way of keeping people localized in their own habitat. And as we look toward the future, one of the things that's very encouraging, at least in the United States, is that we're seeing a lot of investment in alternative energies and in fuels that will be carbon neutral or even carbon negative. And I think that, as Jane Jacobs argues in her work on cities, it's really important that as cities evolve, they start producing as well as consuming products. And one of those products, I think, is going to be energy, whether that's biofuels that are grown in basically urban farms which ring cities, whether those are, you know, cyanobacteria producing energy that we bubble up in vats in our kitchens. I think that having locally produced energy that is efficient and carbon neutral is going to be a huge part of making cities more livable and sustainable. And ultimately, in the long term, what we really want are cities that function as part of their environments, that cities that function as metabolisms. How we do that is partly by incorporating living structures into our cities. And there are actually synthetic biologists who are thinking about this question. How do you build with living materials? How do you use things like algae to become lighting, for example? How do you modify algae to do things like water purification? I talked to one synthetic biology designer in my book who said that she feels like in the future, instead of killing mold in our houses, we'll be cultivating mold, because we'll be using it to do a lot of things that now we use incredibly wasteful industrial products for that pollute the environment. So I think that our cities might end up feeling a lot dirtier than they do now. They might look a little bit like ruins, but they'll be much more congenial in their environments. And that's our best hope, is that we can start really building with nature in mind and building as part of nature. And I think that there's a lot of hopeful work being done right now in that area.
Elizabeth Colbert, do you share this hope with this vision that Anna Lee has put forward?
I certainly hope that these things, you know, come to pass. In my book, I really don't prescribe a future. I think that there are so many issues that we're confronting if we want to change the trend lines that we're on right now. All of the trend lines, all the ones that we talked about, all the big drivers, you know, of extinction. Unfortunately, the trend line is towards more and more impact as opposed to less and less impact. And to turn all those trend lines around, which we really, you know, do need to do if we're going to make a significant difference here in the trajectory that we're on, is a really massive global effort that's going to require, I think, you know, lots and lots of innovations and living very, very differently. As Annalise says, I don't know, you know, what the future is going to look like. I guess one of the interesting things has just been a lot of talk, because it's the 50th anniversary of this 1964 World's Fair, which I actually attended as a very small child. I remember the It's a Small World ride, which I really, really loved. And, you know, to what extent those visions of the future came true or not. What did the future look like? The future, the technological future, is very, very difficult to predict.
There's a couple of other things, Anna Lee, in your book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, that I just wanted you to address. One had to do with the vertical farming, where farms were inside these skyscrapers. Every floor was solar powered with a greenhouse. How real is this?
It hasn't been tried on any kind of massive scale, and there have been a lot of questions and skepticism about whether it would really work and whether it would be energy efficient. The technology of the vertical farm is the idea that you would build a skyscraper that would be just pure greenhouse, basically. It would be letting in light, it would be using all recycled water and all carbon neutral energy to light the plants that weren't getting direct sunlight. And it's a beautiful idea, and I think something like it will have to exist in order for cities to feed themselves in the future. Whether it will be giant glass skyscrapers full of farms, or whether it will be farms growing on the outside of buildings, or whether you'll have something more like urban farming, which is basically just local farming, you know, farms that are right next to your city so that you aren't, you know, wasting energy driving fruit and vegetables all over the place. It's unclear how that's going to work, but I think that the vertical farm is a fantastic thought experiment, because it gets people thinking about how do you start manufacturing food in cities. And not to be too science fictional here, but one of the other things that people are thinking about also is stuff like synthetic meat. How do you start doing tissue engineering on a massive scale so that you don't have to be slaughtering animals and raising animals in terrible conditions in order to get meat protein to people who want to buy it, especially in America. In fact, across the Americas, people love meat, but of course, farms where people are growing meat are terrible for the environment, and a lot of the nutrient runoff is causing that ocean acidification that we were talking about earlier. So that's another futuristic goal along with the vertical farm that I think, you know, people really are going to be exploring quite seriously.
Let's end with Elizabeth Colbert. You've said that if we don't act, this sixth extinction will impact the future of the Earth for all time.
I should say all extinctions have impacted, you know, the future of Earth for all time, because you close off certain evolutionary pathways and those are gone forever. And so, for example, I quote a British paleontologist in the book talking about if the first of these extinctions of, you know, 440 million years ago, if the survivors had been one jot different, so would the world today. It's only the survivors that give rise to new species, and these other pathways just end in dead end. So we are, one of the points I stress in the book is, without at all intending to, that's what we're doing. We're closing off certain evolutionary pathways, and, you know, that's a pretty significant thing to be doing without even being conscious of it.
Well, let me thank both of you. Elizabeth Colbert's new book is called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Anna Lee Newitz's book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
When we come back, April is perhaps the most notorious month for victims of genocide. We'll analyze why genocides happen and how they might be prevented in the future. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. April has been a very dark month for victims of genocide. On April 24, 1915, Turkish authorities began their systematic annihilation of the Armenians in Turkey. On April 7, the Rwandan Hutu power government began exterminating the Tutsi population. In Cambodia, Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime launched its genocidal efforts on April 17. April was also the month that Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic began the Serb offensive to eliminate the Muslim communities in parts of Bosnia. Why does genocide happen, and how can it be prevented? With us are three experts. Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, Cambodia, the Eastern Zone Massacres, and the Pol Pot Regime, Race, Power, and Genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, 1975 to 1979. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide and editor of Genocide, Truth, Memory, and Representation and Annihilating Difference, The Anthropology of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty, and 0 Degrees of Empathy. He's also editor of Understanding Other Minds and the Maladaptive Mind. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ben Kiernan. You've identified 4 primary factors or themes when you've looked across genocides, although you say each are unique. What would you say those primary themes or factors are?
Well, in terms of the mindset of the perpetrators of genocide, the people who later go on to commit genocide or implement genocidal policies, some of the preoccupations and ideas that surface early in their careers and seem to be pointers to their later actions include, for instance, racial hatred or religious prejudice. Obviously, that's part of the definition of genocidal violence against an ethnic or religious or national or racial group. But other factors in the mindset of perpetrators that I found coming up again and again over a long survey of several millennia of genocidal occurrences, not only the racial and religious prejudice, but also an expansionist drive to take over territory. And along with that, a ideological obsession with how the land should be used, not just taking it over and ruling it or even expelling or killing the indigenous population, but also the fact that the correct usage of that land, and it's often agricultural cultivation, and so this leads to a prejudice against urban dwellers or hunter-gatherers, neither of whom are farming populations. And in many cases, not all, genocidal perpetrators have a fetish about cultivation. And along with that, A fourth factor is the kind of obsession with the ancient past of the ethnic group of the perpetrators, which what I call a cult of antiquity, an idea that there was a glorious past that the modern-day perpetrators of genocide, in whatever era they might be in, they're looking back at a glorious past that they want to recapture. And that often has a philosophical connection with their ethnicity, the origins of their ethnic group, which they want to reclaim the glory days of. And it also has something to do with the territory they allegedly once occupied and committing genocide against so-called intruders or people who get in the way of reclaiming that territory and that ancient ethnic purity.
Even the ethnic wars that didn't turn completely genocidal had a component of, say, the greater Serbia or the greater Croatia, greater Bosnia. But those may have not been completely accurate.
Oh, yes, they're often mythical. Sometimes there's a kernel of truth or more than a kernel of truth. Sometimes they're just invented. But quite often there is a kind of irredentist claim that goes along with the expansionism in the sense that this was once our territory. On the other hand, these four factors, when they're together, that's racism, expansionism, the obsession with antiquity and cultivation, they're powerful and explosive as a mix, but sometimes in isolation, just one or even two of the factors don't produce a genocidal outcome. And that's important to note, that even discrimination may not be more than an obsession. It might not even be practiced, and therefore it cannot always lead to genocide. But in combination with a militaristic expansionism, for instance, racial prejudice can be extremely virulent.
Alex Hinton, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your studies?
I'm writing a book that focuses on Doik, who was the commandant of a prison camp in Cambodia, S21, which is now commonly known as Tuol Sleng. And I've sort of looked at three issues. One is, how does genocide come about? And Professor Kiernan has very nicely described a number of the key factors. The second thing is, how do people come to perpetrate acts of genocide and mass violence? And then I'm also looking now at notions of justice and the aftermath of conflict. From an anthropological perspective, I would look also at the way that difference is constructed. As Professor Kiernan was pointing out, that a genocidal regime will envision difference in a certain way so that people belong to the group, in-group, out-group. As it does so, usually the message, the ideological blueprint that they've devised, begins to resonate more with people in a context of socioeconomic upheaval. When a regime has come to power, typically they begin to manufacture differences that people might not otherwise be as aware of suddenly come into the foreground and are actually become linked to ideological messages and often structural messages, legal messages. So people begin to be differentiated in very specific sorts of ways.
Can you give some examples of those so people can understand?
So I'm going to talk about situations where genocide hasn't occurred, but the processes I'm talking about are all around us. With the events taking place in Boston, we have 9/11 as an example in the United States. Immediately in the aftermath of the bombing in Boston and then the seeking suspects, then two brothers have been located and they're being coded as Muslim and Chechenian or from somewhere in that region. Most people probably have never heard of Chechnya, and suddenly that identity is foregrounded. It's something people become aware of, and it becomes fixed and differentiated. It's an us-them differentiation. That's 9/11 with the perception of Muslims and Arab Americans. The same sort of thing went on. And in genocide, it's taken to the extreme. So you have differences in awareness of other sorts of beings through an identity position are foregrounded. They become marked. By this, I mean dehumanized in certain sorts of ways, stigmatized in society. And as part of the blueprint of the ideological regime, and I should just note on the side as well, what I'm talking about is particularly applicable to what are called ideological genocide, colonial genocides, for example. The other thing is then people are rounded up and often confined. They're marked as other, and then the process can begin of eliminating those people. You know, another way sometimes I think about it through the acronym BPERP. B is in belief, the ideological beliefs and the personal views of the perpetrators. The PER is the perspective of people, the way in which the others are defined by ideology and those messages are taken in by individual perpetrators. And the last P in BPERP is for position, and that's the person, the structural position the person occupies in the system and the position of the victim. And those three things interact over time, and the foregrounding of one of those three factors can be more prominent within a given context.
One other aspect that you had done in your work pertained to the psychosocial phenomena like honor, what you called face. How do these come into play? Honor particularly seems like it would be a contradiction to genocide, but you found them intertwined in some way.
Absolutely. One of the things that often emerges in explanations of mass violence, and especially genocide, is the notion that there's no meaning to it, it's meaningless. Today on a radio station, there was a student in Boston who said, there's no logic to this. there is a logic. There are sets of cultural understandings that inform action. One of the things that a perpetrator regime will need to do as they envision difference, when they're envisioning difference, is they need to cast their ideology, in the case of the Khmer Rouge, for example, Marxist-Leninism was extreme in a way that people on the ground are going to understand. So if you're trying to appeal to peasants who don't have a great degree of formal education but may have been educated in the pagoda, as was the case, these terms are taken and molded and adapted so that they're going to resonate with local conceptions. Among the things that perpetrator regime may play upon are notions of status, which is linked to honor, face. People often think of genocide, mass murder, as if there are these maniacal ideologues who come about and manipulate a bunch of followers who blindly do whatever they say, but it's much more complicated than that. It's actually difficult to try and motivate people to do things that otherwise go against at least some of their beliefs, and this is a struggle that many perpetrator regimes have to deal with, and it changes through time, and sometimes it leads to the downfall of the group.
Simon Baron-Cohen, let's bring you in. You've been looking at the psychological basis of cruelty, of evil. You've identified a missing component among people who perpetrate these things, and that is empathy. How does it happen that people fail to either develop empathy or that develop the loss of empathy?
The points that Ben and Alex have made sit very comfortably within the framework of empathy. They've really been highlighting social factors that can lead an individual to lose their empathy in certain situations. Ben was talking about racism as one of his four factors. If the propaganda around racism is potent enough, you can lose your empathy for the other person, the person in the out-group. And Alex was talking about a very social, psychological perspective, in-group, out-group relations, that often when a racist propaganda is being created, the out-group will be described in very dehumanized language so that the in-group have reduced empathy for members of the out-group. And I think we saw that in genocides like Rwanda, where the propaganda was describing one ethnic group as subhuman, and you know, once you no longer see the person as a person, but see them as a subhuman or an object, then of course you become capable of treating them as an object. And I think that you know, the missing component in the discussion so far is about the brain. I'm a neuroscientist, and what we've seen in recent research is a greater understanding of the brain basis of empathy. And what you can see when you image the brain whilst the individual is looking at somebody else and responding to someone else's emotions is that we all vary in how much empathy we have and in how much the empathy circuit in the brain is activated, for example, if we see somebody else in distress. So there are individual differences in empathy, and it may be some of those social, psychological factors, in-group, out-group relations, racism, you know, these kinds of things. For some individuals, it'll be enough to push them even lower down that empathy bell curve so that they become capable of hurting another person.
So what you're saying is that empathy can actually be turned off.
That's right. I mean, there are individual differences in empathy. There are different ways of measuring it, either using questionnaires or other kinds of psychological tests. And what you find is that some people have a lot of empathy, some people have just average amounts, and some people are starting off much lower, below average. But then there are situational factors that can make an individual have more or less empathy in a given situation. And, you know, when we try to make sense of why some people lose their empathy or fail to develop it in the first place, we have to look at both individual factors, for example, their genetics, their biology, but also these social factors.
I think two things arise from that. One is, on a mass level, how can empathy be erased? Is that what psychologists talk about when they talk about mob behavior or intergroup emotions that comes into play? And can empathy then be turned on for those people who may have previously had it shut off?
Both questions are really good. You know, the first one about crowd behavior. If you're in a group and you feel under threat, it's going to be hard to sustain your empathy for those who you believe are threatening you. So if the propaganda is telling you that the other group is about to attack, about to invade, they're about to even attack your family, you have a very primitive reaction. Biologically, your cortisol hormone increases to get you ready for fight or flight. And in that condition, in that state, it's much harder to remember or to stay focused on the other person's feelings. All you want to do is defend yourself and defend those who you love. Whereas in other conditions, for example, peace or post-genocide, if there's a kind of reconciliation process where you come face-to-face with the victim, your empathy could recover, where you begin to see the person, as a victim, with all of their subjectivity.
We certainly saw a little bit of that in South Africa during the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. It wasn't a genocide per se, but some horrible human rights conditions. Alex Hinton, let me bring you back in for just a moment, because this sort of ties to what you called psychosocial dissonance. What is that, and how is it related to genocidal activity?
No, that's very relevant to the discussion. The notion of psychosocial dissonance speaks to Festinger's notion of cognitive dissonance, but places it into a socio-cultural context. So in other words, if people have different belief structures and they're brought into tension, it creates a dissonance. So one obvious thing that takes place in situations of mass violence and genocide is that most people then socialize not to kill or harm other human beings in one sense, but then they're put in a context where they're told that, for example, these aren't really human beings, they're evil enemies, microbes, viruses, so on and so forth. And that goes back to the marking of difference. But there's still a tension that someone still, in some sense, may or may not see a human being. And if they see them that way and they're told they're an enemy and need to be killed, it may create a dissonance, a tension within them that needs to be resolved. And there are a number of different cognitive steps they can take. I think empathy is absolutely critical, as are other emotions like shame, and findings from neuroscience, psychopathology are directly relevant. But I'm a little bit wary that there's a tendency for things to become overly biologized and for people to give primacy to something. And I'm not saying that Simon is doing this. I'm saying that it's something that exists with many people, where people want to look for the genetic roots of different things. And I think there's a danger that if that factor, which can be relevant in different ways, is taken and given primacy, it can then divert our attention from absolutely key social, cultural, and historical factors that are operative. And I sort of just put that caveat in. So it's not to disagree with Simon, but to say that for people who are listening, that we do have this cultural bias that exists in our society where we like to biologize things. And in terms of understanding genocide and mass violence, it's important not to have that come in and frame our understanding, or we'll lose sight of other important factors.
But rather just to understand that these are all contributors, and they're all things that we need to understand together as a construction of what we see in the world.
Absolutely. There are certain ways in which myths like Lord of the Flies, where you have this notion that people can have civilization, but they're brought, these kids go to this island, and suddenly the veneer of civilization is removed and people are acting upon their baser evolved instincts. So we have these ways of thinking that float around, and again, there are ways in which factors linked to biology and evolution, emotion, neuropsychology are all relevant, but it jives with what people tend to think with their common folk understandings. I think that's an important caveat to put in there.
A quick reminder, this is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the forces of genocide. There have been a number of genocides that have remained either unacknowledged or underacknowledged or flat out denied. Ben Kiernan, you've written about Native Americans. There's the Armenian genocide in Australia, considerable denial of what happened with the Aborigines people. First of all, remind us of what did occur, and then give us a sense of what the cost is of unacknowledgement, underacknowledgement, or flat-out denial.
I would just like to quickly refer to what both Simon and Alex were just saying, if I could, because they both made a lot of sense to me. Alex talking about the broader historical factors, and Simon talking about empathy and the different gradations of empathy amongst different people. And I think that makes it hard for genocidal groups to recruit in normal situations. And what happens is that they tend to only thrive in the conditions of historical and social upheaval, war, massive destabilization, economic upheaval, In the Cambodian case, it was the massive intrusion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia and the widespread bombing that took place. And that enabled the Khmer Rouge to recruit supporters, but they also had to work on the existing empathy of many of those supporters by telling them who to attack and who was responsible for the bombing and so on. And they deliberately did that in telling the population they were recruiting, whose villages had been bombed and whose families had been uprooted, that they were being attacked not by the United States Air Force, but by the Phnom Penh population, the capital city, and the population there. And that turned a lot of the violence of the attacked peasantry against the cities. In terms of the number of genocides that have occurred in the 20th century, sometimes these are disguised or hidden behind wars. So it's often thought in some cases that such and such a genocide was not a genocide but a civil war. Often both are going on. They're not necessarily one or the other, but overlapping factors. One of the things that genocide studies and the field has uncovered over the last 50 years or so, particularly since the work of Raphael Lemkin, who really began this in the 1940s and was instrumental in having the Genocide Convention become international law, is that there were a large number of cases in history, and indeed since the Genocide Convention has become law, of genocide breaking out. Now, one of those that was for long not given the attention that it deserved was the genocide in Guatemala, for which a former president of Guatemala is now facing trial in that country. He's actually the first former head of state in the Americas to face trial for genocide. And the destruction of indigenous populations in Guatemala in the 1980s is still an event that hasn't got the attention that it deserves. I think it's true of many indigenous cases. Not all colonial or conquests of indigenous peoples led to genocide, but a number of them did, both in the Australian continent and in North America and Central and South America as well. And the genocide in Guatemala only 30 years ago is a kind of reflection of one of the worst cases of that.
In terms of people who dissent or try to stop genocidal activity, what can we learn from them? I'll start with Alex.
I also wanted to return to your question about genocides that are out of focus, because I think it taps into a key thread that's emerging within the field of genocide studies. Some people have referred to it as critical genocide studies. And one part would be sort of informed by the Frankfurt School and critical theory, but another part focuses more on sort of destabilizing the tacit presuppositions of the field and the categories that lead us to look at things in certain sorts of ways. Just briefly, there has for a long time, in some sense, been a model of genocide that's informed by the Holocaust, with Auschwitz being the through metonymy standing for sort of epitomizing what genocide is. And I think that informed the UN Genocide Convention. And linked to this, people often talk about referring to some cases of mass violence as genocide, saying, well, if we call too many things genocide, it will dilute the meaning of the term. I call this the dilution metaphor, and it's sort of a gatekeeping metaphor and one that has ontological resonance in the sense that we all know what an impurity is, and it's something that we're familiar with. But there's no reason why we shouldn't necessarily, if cases fit a definition, referred to them as genocide. So it's this gatekeeping notion. I think a real shift in genocide studies has been that people are starting to look at a much larger range of cases. You know, at the center I direct, we recently had a conference, and there's a volume coming out called Hidden Genocides. Another scholar has a book called Forgotten Genocides. Ben has the volume that's been really critical in this move of sort of looking at the broad historical purview of genocide in a variety of different contexts, and probably has, you know, the foundational text. This has been a big shift to look at these sort of cases that are off the map that we haven't looked at because we have certain sorts of biases and preconceptions.
Knowing what we know psychologically, neurologically, sociologically, politically, Simon Baron-Cohen, what can we do to prevent genocide?
Just before I move to that question, the previous question was about hidden genocides or genocides that are off the radar. And I just wanted to mention that it's the 100th anniversary, as we know, of the Armenian genocide coming up. And it's just an opportunity for your listeners to, if they don't know about it, to go and read about it and learn about it. This is the Turkish Holocaust, it might be called, against the Armenians back in 1915 when Turkey constructed 25 concentration camps just outside of Turkey's border in Syria, with resulting huge numbers of Armenians being killed. So we just need to remember some of these other Holocausts that don't get the media attention that, for example, the Nazi Holocaust did and does. And to me, this reminds me that the risk of genocide is in every culture. It's not about a specific culture, and maybe that's the kind of link to prevention, that if we can identify, as Alex started out doing, some of the factors that together make a very potent risk, and start to educate people to watch out for these things in certain situations. That might be one step towards prevention, that when the media and when governments are using propaganda, history can show us that we can easily fall for it, but equally once the analysis is laid out, you can then reflect, and that might be one step to guard against just succumbing to the impact of propaganda.
Ben Kiernan?
Along with the hidden genocides, there are also the hidden rescues, indeed the hidden rescuers and the hidden resistance. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times today by Marcy Shaw, which talks about the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and she actually makes the point that although in some ways it was a hopeless cause, it did delay for several months the deportations from Warsaw to Auschwitz. We need to give more attention to the people who rescued victims or resisted and in fact inflicted casualties on the perpetrators and perhaps delayed or even offset or reduced the number of victims. That's one of the ways to look at prevention, is to study what it is that makes rescue possible and what kinds of people respond to requests to rescue or hide or otherwise shelter or help potential victims. One of the other aspects of genocide, at least as known in the public arena, is the lack of information about resistance. There were, in many cases, resistance movements that sprung up against genocide perpetrators and their regimes, whether it was in Bangladesh or East Timor or Cambodia or under the Nazi Holocaust or elsewhere. The people who try to prevent on the spot the deportation or murder of genocide victims really deserve more attention than they've got.
And Alex Hinton.
I agree with my colleague. I would just add that critical self-reflection is an absolutely key thing, because many of the dynamics that are taken to the extreme in genocide are around us all of the time. Peer pressure is just an example, bullying, so on and so forth. Awareness of what's occurred in general through educational initiatives enhances the awareness of what potential exists in different societies and how genocide sometimes can come on fairly quickly. In other cases, it has a much longer duration. The notion that Simon foregrounded of empathy, I think, is absolutely critical. And from my anthropological frame, I would also sort of cast that in terms of this notion of understanding how we envision difference in different sorts of ways, how difference is crystallized, but to come to try and understand other people as opposed to readily going along with whatever ways difference is being catalyzed. And certainly in Boston right now, that's something that's being debated and at the forefront of discussions, even though, again, that's not a case of genocide, but that dynamic is one that you find taken to the extreme in genocide. Another key factor is international apathy, where people just don't care or it's not a quote-unquote strategic priority and people don't pay attention to it. I might conclude by noting that, in a sense, genocide prevention always fails, because if there's ever a successful genocide prevention, we'll never know.
You mentioned the international apathy. Do you think that the move towards tribunals and the International Criminal Court are having an impact on reducing either a full-out genocide or at least the kinds of mass human rights abuses that we have seen?
I think people's common folk perceptions, our ways of understanding, is that, yes, if you bring people to justice, it will fight impunity and act as a deterrence. And there's certainly some truth to that, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to just say, oh, we have this one thing and it will always work. That's one among a number of factors that need to be attended to. And in some ways, it's one that is often foregrounded. So it's great that we have these initiatives to have justice. But in the case, you know, in some of the cases, like Guatemala or Cambodia right now, Argentina, the question immediately arises, why did it take so long to get to this point? So all the events that occurred during those years beforehand, they're historical events, political events, and they're questions that need to be asked about why it is that only now we're getting at this moment in time. It's not to say it's not good that we have it, but I think by only focusing on what's going on with the tribunals now, we erase other things that may be directly relevant, including, for example, geopolitics.
One of the things we didn't talk about was the legitimation of political violence in certain circumstances. And let me just do a final comment. Simon Baron-Cohen?
One point made earlier, I think by Alex, was that we shouldn't let biology take any primacy. And I would agree with that, that whether we're taking a sociological or anthropological or a biological approach, none of these have primacy. They're all just contributing factors in the mix.
And Ben Kiernan.
Absolutely. Multi-pronged prevention is the only way to go. I think it's the Human Security Report, sponsored by the UN, came up with the conclusion that the number of genocides has slightly decreased in the late 90s and in the 21st century, and that may have something to do with the first international criminal tribunals for both Bosnia and Rwanda. But also, I think it's got something to do with the end of the Cold War, or more importantly, perhaps an awareness that conflict has to be avoided, that there needs to be attention given to not starting new wars, that there needs to be attention given to resolution of poverty and other historical and social problems that allow genocidal perpetrators to recruit supporters. I think that's absolutely key.
Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work. Alex Hinton, Ben Kiernan, Simon Baron-Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty and 0 Degrees of Empathy. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.